Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 23rd of November 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish. We're also joined by Mark Anderson and David Scott. Probably the Minister of War.
Yes, we're going to start off with the Minister of War here. Here he is, Gavin Williamson, meeting, well, who is he meeting? The Minister of Defence for the Ukraine yesterday. So in a meeting with the visiting Ukrainian Defence Minister Stepan Poltorak, Gavin Williamson announced a range of forthcoming deployments and exercises that will see the two countries' armed forces continue to work together in defence and international rules-based, sorry, in defence of the international rules-based order. This is their words. It's fantastic stuff. The Defence Secretary announced at the meeting that HMS Echo would deploy to the Black Sea in 2019 to demonstrate the UK's support for ensuring freedom of navigation in the region. It was also confirmed that in January and February next year, training teams made up of personnel from the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and the Army will deploy to Ukraine as part of the extension of the UK's military training operation announced by Gavin Williamson at the visit to the country a few weeks ago in September. Well, this is what Gav the Chav had to say. As long as Ukraine faces Russian hostilities, it will find a steadfast partner in the United Kingdom. So that's fantastic stuff. They issued a joint statement that I thought was worth just looking at a couple of points from. So they stress that the aggression towards Ukraine by the Russian Federation is a direct threat to the Euro-Atlantic security and a challenge to the existing system of international relations. And they underline that the ongoing breach of ceasefire arrangements by Russian-backed formations and other illegal groups leads to daily losses among the Ukrainian military and civil population, and urge Russia and its proxies to commit to full implementation of the Minsk agreements. And they say that they condemn the increased military presence of the Russian Federation around Ukraine's borders, in the territories of Donetsk and so on, and in the illegally seized Autonomous Republic of Crimea, and the Russian Federation's destabilizing actions in the area of the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. And finally, they agree to deepen cooperation in countering Russia's aggression, malign activity and abuse of the rules-based international system in Ukraine, in the UK and elsewhere. Well, as you would imagine, the Russians had something to say about this. So this was a statement from the Russian embassy in London. This decision goes against the imperative for resolving the Ukrainian conflict through political and diplomatic means on the basis of the Minsk agreements, which the UK claims to be committed to. Ukraine continues to ignore its obligations under the package of measures for implementation of the Minsk agreements by relying on a military solution to the conflict and refusing to negotiate directly with Donetsk representatives. The remarks of Mr. Williamson show that instead of putting all possible pressure on Kiev, the British government supports and even encourages the Ukrainian authorities to continue their military operation against their own people. And they went on to say it is officially confirmed that the British troops stationed in Ukraine are actively involved in the training of armed forces that conduct a military operation in the east. The fighting leads to numerous civilian casualties and a further deterioration of the humanitarian situation on the ground. It's clear that the British military build-up, albeit a symbolic one, can only aggravate the situation and in no way contribute to a peaceful settlement. In a broader context, such steps fit into the NATO strategy of stepping up its military presence in Ukraine, coupled with increased activity in the Black Sea. This is a matter of deep concern. So welcome David Scott to the programme here. David, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, which of these statements do you find to be more credible?
Well, once again, clearly the Russian embassy is the place that we have to look for some form of rationality. Right? Now, leaving aside we're sending one ship to the Black Sea to ensure freedom of navigation problem, right? Which is that actually a credible force? And leaving aside the fact that we are we're getting involved right in the Russian doorstep. Let's just imagine what it would be like if it was switched. Look at it from the other point of view. I suppose an equivalent would be there's a United Ireland, there's a large minority that wants to be British in that continent, and the Russians are training the Irish to help shelling of people who want to be British, how would we feel about that? The degree to which this doesn't have any appreciation for the Russian point of view, for the point of view of the people on the ground, for any of the complexities, seems to be once again a complete failure of diplomacy. There's no subtlety, there's no reasonableness in our approach. And this issue of an international rules-based order, that's code for many things, but what it's not code for is lawful conduct.
Brian, would the Russians be unreasonable to consider this a warlike act?
Well, I don't think so, because it's not an incident on its own. It's set against a backdrop of continual military expansion right up to the Russian border. But I will just say HMS Echo, for people who don't know, is a hydrographic survey ship. So this is where I see that there is this outrageous chasm in what the British government says it is doing. We're pushing out naval units. No, they're pushing out a pretty old hydrographic survey ship into the area as if it was a proper force projection. So we haven't got the equipment, but we're making the aggressive steps. When the trouble starts, the body bags are overwhelmingly going to be American forces, because without the Americans on the ground, there is no effective European defence in Europe. So the casualties are going to be American, and they're going to be the cannon fodder of those former Eastern Soviet states. And this is all being orchestrated by Britain's deep state government.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, David, let's move on to the EU. And well, we're starting off here with a nice picture of Napoleon, it seems.
Well, yes, this is relevant. And I also picked a nice Napoleon quote that Mark would appreciate, because it shows it's kind of Obama-esque. It shows that there are no new things under the sun. A leader is a dealer in hope. Well, this is Napoleon, and he was, of course, essentially emperor of Europe. And we're going to need more of these, because while the French finance minister has been interviewed by a German newspaper, and he's been talking about exactly that. What he says here, he says, it's all very well to express European unity during memorials for the fallen in past world wars, but genuine unity, and look what he defines it as, political, financial and military, is still lacking inside the European Union, according to France's finance minister, Bruno Le Maire. This is an exclusive interview with Handelsblatt's newspaper in Germany. He goes on, so I'm using this phrase because in tomorrow's world, it's going to be all about power. Technological power, economic, financial, monetary, cultural. He doesn't say military, but that's included. All will be decisive. Europe cannot be shy any longer about using its power. We have talked about it for a long time. Now it's time for decisions. And there will be decisions made on December 4 at the next meeting of the economy and finance ministers. I cannot imagine anything else. Everybody knows it takes guts to stand in the way of Donald Trump's administration. The people of Europe have had enough of the babble from Brussels. They want to see action. So the whole context, the whole tone is urgent and immediate. And what he's saying here is that there are two options immediately facing Europe. The first option is full unification. Now that's financial, and financial means banking and tax, right? Taxation is theft, banking is fraud. They need them both to project power. And military, EU military unification, and political unification. They need a full sovereign European state. And he uses that phrase, sovereign. Europe is sovereign. He uses that phrase. And the alternative is for Europe to collapse. So whilst we've been looking at Brexit, the Europeans have been realising it's much later than you think. And everything's been accelerating hugely.
You couldn't be suggesting that Brexit is being used as a cover for all this.
You would think that would be impossible, but it appears that the world has changed since 2016, and we are going to be forced to change with it.
Let me welcome Mark Anderson to the programme now then, and because if we're talking about empire building and the need for policing, perhaps, you've posted an article on your Truthhound website, Mark, entitled G9, the New World Police Force Being Pushed by Chicago, New York foreign policy establishments. Give us the breakdown on this then.
Yeah, it's ironic that I write this up and this kind of information is coming out. I don't compare notes with David Scott. I don't compare notes necessarily with you guys all the time. And yet everything fits together like a puzzle. And what we're looking at here is a Council on Foreign Relations, the leader of the Council on Foreign Relations, the senior vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations, James W. Lindsay, working together with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs president, Ewald Dalder, the former U.S. envoy to NATO, and they wrote an article recently in the Foreign Affairs Journal of the CFR called The Committee to Save the World Order. I gather my thoughts here. It's kind of early in Michigan. And the Committee to Save the World Order is otherwise known as a proposed G9. And the G9 would consist of the United Kingdom and France, Germany, Italy, the EU as a body, as one sovereign nation, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and Canada. Those would be the members of the G9 or the Committee to Save the World Order. And what they say, Mr. Lindsay and Mr. Dalder in their foreign affairs article is, quote, the major allies of the United States can leverage their collective economic and military might to save the liberal world order. France, Germany, Italy, the UK, the EU and Europe, Australia, Japan, South Korea, Asia, and Canada, I might have left out Australia a second ago, are the obvious candidates to supply the leadership that the Trump administration will not supply. Together, this G9 represents the largest economic power in the world, and their collective military capabilities are surpassed only by those of the U.S. This G9 should have two imperatives: maintain the rules-based world order in the hope that Trump's successor will reclaim Washington's global leadership role, and lay the groundwork to make it politically possible for that to happen. And they say that, quote, economic cooperation is a good place to start, and would-be potential G9 members are already creating alternatives to the trade deals Trump is abandoning, but they will have to go further. Here's a key point: increasing military cooperation and defense spending and using a variety of tools at their disposal to take over the U.S. role as the defender and promoter of democracy, freedom, and human rights across the globe. So Trump is seen as abandoning the rules-based world order to a sufficient degree, in these guys' view, that the G9, including the EU and the EU's military that you guys are talking about, would take over at least a significant portion of the U.S. global policing role. And so that shows that the EU army is meant to be, in essence, a global army. At least that's the potential that they see in it. And so it's amazing the kind of plans that have been laid out while everybody's been fighting over Brexit, while everybody's been fighting over Trump's Twitter posts and all these things that can be diversionary in some cases. But this is the kind of thinking that the think tanks are doing, very strategic stuff, and it all fits hand in glove with the themes you guys have been talking about.
Well, if that's the strategic thinking, of course, there is some reality going on as well, because as you mentioned the last time you were on the program, Mark, the Global Parliament of Mayors event was taking place in Bristol, the annual summit. Well, this is the report that has come out of that. But I mean, what are your thoughts on what took place during that meeting?
Yeah, I studied up on it quite a bit, guys. And I'll mention briefly a quick plug here. I know you guys are talking about putting out the column, a print publication. I believe that's the name you have for it. If not, correct me. There'll be a longer article, as I understand it, on the G9 written by myself in the inaugural edition of your print publication. And that's also going to take into account the flip side of the G9, or the Committee to Save the World Order. And that flip side is the Global Cities Movement. And I see a connection between the two, as above, so below. And going to the grassroots with the Global Parliament of Mayors that met October 21 through 23 in Bristol, UK, it was their third annual summit. There were 67 mayors from 36 countries, and they named that there are 99 global cities networks, and leaders from 12 of those networks met in Bristol at this meeting. And a lot could be said about it. I know that you have a lot of things to cover today, but one of the things they made very clear is that, quote, the mayors of the world want to create a safer, more inclusive, and sustainable world by strengthening the rights of cities. The cities see themselves as having rights like individuals. And then they go about saying that in support of United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the Global Parliament of Mayors will, among other things, quote, build an active, impactful, and structured network of, by, and for mayors. This is this 99 global cities networks. They're going to have more of those networks, and they're going to solidify the existing ones. Amplify a united global voice for cities and their residents. Enhance cooperation, connectivity, and solidarity between city leaders and global agendas by mobilizing regional and local action. But one of the kickers is a quote that is a little further down, and what I'm reading from is a large, slick report that they produced. It's 50 or 60 pages, I think, a full-color report that's available at the Global Parliament of Mayors website. And one of the most revealing quotes, among many things that I could quote, is that they said the following, quote, today's international political and legal system was established in the post-war years, which placed nation states at the center of global governance. Cities have been absent and are power light, or light on power. But that is beginning to change as cities band together in networks to pierce, interesting word, pierce, participate in, and transcend the current political world order. Get that, transcend the current political world order. Again, a very interesting choice of words. Their growing success and profile is being described as municipal internationalism, transnational municipal networking, municipal foreign policy. Get that one. Municipal foreign policy. That's like swallowing a basketball, right? And the international municipal movement. So these guys are looking at things from a pretty highfalutin standpoint. I could go on, but they laid out three basic declarations, and this is probably the most important thing to summarize this with. The three basic declarations are harnessing the power of migration for inclusive cities, strengthening urban security through city leadership, and driving good population health. And if you read through the report from the Bristol meeting of this Global Parliament of Mayors, what you'll see is a lot of contradictions and hypocrisy. And one is that they really talk about unbridled migration as if national borders don't exist or are largely irrelevant. And yet at the same time, they talk about security, particularly urban security, and warding off pandemics and infectious disease. Well, how do you ward off pandemics and infectious disease if you have unbridled immigration from all sorts of different parts of the world? And how do you strengthen urban security, much less ward off pandemics, again, if you have this idea that national populations should just flow into one another, unbridled and unregulated? So this is one of the most striking things among many, is not only do they have this strange vision of municipal internationalism, but this idea that enforcing any kind of border security at all is anathema to them. And this, you see this again and again and again.
Thank you very much for that, Mark. That's hugely interesting.
Well, unbelievably dangerous, Mike, isn't it? Because you just imagine those meetings and those people together, really out of sight of the public. Okay, we can say, yes, they're reporting on what they're doing, but the actual discussions take place out of sight of the public. And while they're having these high-level strategic decisions on transforming the world order, somebody in our chat box has said what they're not doing is repairing the holes in the road and caring for the very cities that they are mayors of. This is common purpose language, Mark. That's what I get in my head as you read through that. This is exactly what this pernicious political charity Common Purpose was doing way back from 1985 onwards. And of course, they were effectively the Trojan horse that put the seeds of this new style of thinking into many of these organisations.
Okay, look, we've got a lot to get through, so let's move on. A quick advertisement for Alternative View 9.1, Democracy and Change, taking place on the 2nd of December, Sunday the 2nd of December, in the Crown Plaza Hotel in London. Details at alternativeview.co.uk. Do get along to that if possible. And of course, the trial of, or at least the sentencing hearings for David Noakes continue over the GC MAF issue. He's been on the stand in the last couple of days. He was asked today by the judge, apparently, if he thought it was worth producing an unlicensed medicine in order to get this GC MAF out into the marketplace. And he thought, he was asked if it was worth breaking the law in order to do that. And he said, in order to save people's lives, it was certainly worth breaking the law. So that's the latest from the court case. Now, that is clearly going to go into next week. And we're not certain exactly when the sentence is likely to be given, but Tuesday or Wednesday, I think, is most likely.
Yeah. Yeah. And a pretty courageous remark from David Noakes, because,
absolutely,
of course, he's nailed his colours to the mast. It is going to be fascinating to see what the result of this trial is, because the impact on anybody daring to come forward with some form of... I'm trying to avoid the word treatment, because we're not allowed to say treatment, but some form of aid to people who are suffering from cancer and indeed other diseases. If the state doesn't want your involvement, you're going to be sent to prison. We've also got Sabine McNeil. Her case is still going on. Sabine was trying to inform the public about the principally about the Hampstead child abuse case, but of course she's been a campaigner trying to expose the cover-up of child abuse in many cases, and has even spoken in Europe on the subject. She's being taken through the courts now, and at 74 years of age, with severe arthritis, she has hours of travel to and from the court. She's currently in Bronsfeld Prison, and she's having a very painful journey to and from the court, because they won't give her bail simply because she's been trying to warn the public about child abuse.
We should just mention, Brian, we received a letter today from Sabine, addressed to a Jim B. Now, clearly the only address that she had for Jim B was this address. So if you are the Jim B that wrote to Sabine that she's replying to, if you could get in touch with us and give us your address, we will forward that letter on to you. Okay, let's move on. And fake news. And we're starting with the BBC here, who, this was published yesterday, but it's still on the BBC news website today. The headline is Skripal Poisoning: Policeman's Family Lost Everything Because of Novichok. And this is the latest video, I don't really know how to describe it, from BBC Panorama. They're talking about the police officer who was allegedly poisoned by Novichok when he went to investigate the Skripal poisoning at their house. This is Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey. And he said that everything that the kids owned, we lost all that, the cars, we lost that, we lost everything. But it's fascinating what they're saying here, Brian. The opening text on this, on the subtitling on this, says one moment you have a nurse coming in with a sandwich for you, dressed top to bottom in protective gear, closely followed by my wife and kids, who are just allowed to walk in. So it's very confusing. So I'm not going to suggest that Nick Bailey is lying, or that he's in on some kind of conspiracy here. But the point is that everything that was going on around this case remains so ridiculous. And here we have the BBC, BBC Panorama in this case, doubling down on this narrative. Well, I'm pushing it forward once again. Yeah. And I can see how somebody who is extremely ill in hospital sees people coming in with protective gear in one hand, and then immediately afterwards, the same people that are wearing protective gear allow his family in without protective gear. I can see how that would be confusing for him.
Nothing stacks up, Mike. If we come back to the original thing, we are led to believe that the Skripals were poisoned by the door handle. So they are poisoned by a military grade nerve agent. And what do? They go and spend a couple of hours having drinks and in a restaurant before they even start to feel unwell. This has got to be complete nonsense, or all of the nerve agent training conducted by the British military during the Cold War was itself complete nonsense.
Indeed, this is something that's said in this report once again. So Nick Bailey apparently went to the house of the Skripals dressed fully in gear for forensic examination.
Yeah.
So he was wearing gloves and so on. He went into the house. He says he doesn't know how the Novichok got from the gloves, because he assumes that's where the Novichok was, onto his skin, but he may have scratched his face or adjusted his goggles or something like this.
Yeah.
But the point is, he didn't start to feel ill until the following day.
Yeah. So we have just got no common denominator with what took place here. And as the Russians are saying, I think it's on their foreign ministry website at the moment, they're talking about sort of 230 days have gone past and the British government has still not produced one shred of real evidence as to what took place here. So he's in hospital. Presumably the nurses think he's still toxic if they're coming in wearing face masks and special gear. But here's your family. They can come in and visit you anyway. The reason for the discrepancy, in my opinion, is because the whole story is one fantasy and lie by the British government. And because it is such a big lie, they cannot make the individual pieces stick together. That's my opinion.
Well, here's one still from the little piece of video that's on the BBC News website at the moment. And 2 points to make out of this. First of all, of course, we've been told over the months and years that one way to identify fake news is to look for typographical errors. And apparently what Professor Tim here is saying is we identified that the material was a nerve agent called Novichok. So unfortunately, there's a typo there, so that must be fake news. But the key point here is that this man is not being identified. This apparently is the top government scientist dealing with nerve agents, and he is known as Professor Tim. And in the text of the article, the word Tim is in inverted commas. They haven't put it in inverted commas in this, on this still. So we get to see his face, but we don't get to know who he is. And so how do we know? Is he an actor? Is this man an actor? We have no way of knowing, because we can't know that who he is, and we can't know what his role is.
Oh, but Mike, this is the BBC. The BBC has told us that they don't need to name their journalists. They don't need to give any more information, because if you read it, if you see it on a BBC website, then you can rest assured it's true.
Okay. Let's stick on with the subject of fake news. And I want to introduce you to Bruno Studer, who is a member of the French government. And he's in the UK today doing some really important work. But he was speaking on BBC Radio 4 this morning on the Today programme, because the French on Tuesday this week passed some legislation which means that judges now have the power decide or to have cases presented in front of them and decide whether information which is put on the internet should be removed from the internet. This is what Bruno Studer had to say. We don't call it fake news in France. We call it false information and the manipulation of information. And he said that this law is not about fighting false information. It's about fighting the massive spread of that information. So I've paraphrased at the end here, because he went on to talk about how they needed to find a balance between freedom of speech and the ability to protect elections. And so what he's effectively saying is, so it won't infringe on your right to free speech, but it will merely prevent anyone from finding out about what you're saying. So that's the position that they are taking at the moment. He was very determined not to use the term fake news, but at the end of the day, he wasn't able to stop the phrase from tripping off his tongue. He doesn't like that phrase, because he tried to suggest that this was a Trumpian phrase, and really he didn't want to use it. But anyway, he is in London, as I say, today, Brian, and he is, of course, chair of the French Culture Committee, and he is meeting Damien Collins, his colleague, as he described him. And is he meeting him, do you think, in the Houses of Parliament, Brian?
I wouldn't have thought so.
No, he's meeting him in the French embassy. Now, we know what happened the last time. There were secret meetings it's not really a secret meeting, but we know what happened last time there were meetings of this type in the French embassy. We ended up with a defence pact.
Franco-British, assisted by the charity, the Franco-British Council. But the other man we should remember is Olivier Wilier, who was brought in from Sarkozy's government. to help advise Westminster on using applied behavioural psychology to get their political programme across to the British public. And the bulk of those meetings were held in secret, also facilitated by the Franco-British Council.
David, we'll move north of the border now, and hatred and division in Scotland. But first of all, is it fake news that rocks have been hurled through the through Ruth Davidson's office windows?
Well, I think the chap tried quite hard, but the toughened and laminated glass here seems to be equal to the task. So apparently Ruth Davidson wasn't present, but her staff were cowering inside as a man stood quite calmly outside and hurled half bricks at the window until he was stopped by some passers-by. So now, this is not the first time we've had vandalism attacks on Conservative offices in Scotland. It's been quite common. And I've got a couple of points here from England. One, you've got John McDonnell talking about his hatred and saying he could never be friends with a Tory. So here you're seeing the division of the society is us and them. It's hate the other. Don't speak to people. Don't understand the point of view. Don't discuss ideas. Don't appreciate that they have something to say. No, hate them, exclude them, deplatform them. And in the other little diagram there was a Welsh teacher. And he announced to the party conference, the Labour Party conference, to applause, that if we bring up our children properly, as defined by the state, there won't be any Tories, right? Because that strand of thought will be eliminated by schooling and by proper re-education. So it's extremely creepy and totalitarian. And we're losing the ability to talk to one another. This is not good.
Okay, and also in Scotland, then, are we looking at another independence referendum? Well, the headline here is Robin McAlpin: "We're letting history pass independence by. The movement should be angry." So is this about starting to get some angst and anger and hatred into the independence discussion then?
Well, no, this is a realisation. This is the penny dropping. I went along a year ago to a meeting of a Yes group in Perth to ask some questions. And one of the questions I asked was, look, you're talking about how to organise for a new independence referendum, but you're not talking about what it should be about. There's no ideas being discussed. Where are the ideas discussed? Because you're telling people what we're going to campaign for. There's no discussion. Where is the discussion? And there was a kind of awkward silence, and then they pointed to common space. There's discussion there. So this is the think tank. This is as intellectual as it gets. Now, I have a lot of problems with common space, largely because the economic policies are every sort of stupid under the sun, but they're genuine and they do try and have discussions about issues. Now, this is what he says. He said, "My communications over the last week are anything to go by. The movement is utterly confused and increasingly demoralised, with a steady growth in shares of fury. We're all clutching at straws and we can barely find a straw to grasp. When we're going to face up to reality, we have no coordinated campaign structure in place. We have very little serious preparatory work done from which to build a serious campaign. We've done little to take on the difficult questions that inevitably await us. Jazz, borders, currency, export, trade, all float in the air like ghosts while we hide under the bed. Commonweal has done its very best to produce constructive work on a new prospectus, but we are simply ignored, and the movement has nothing serious to offer Scotland beyond a rehash of the 2014 White Paper and the utterly calamitous Growth Commission report, which will sink us all, but somehow floats around undead on a sea of paralysis." Right? And he talks about the utter failure of leadership in the Scottish National Movement. Now, this is something I've been commenting on from a different point of view, but it's been very striking to me that there's been no intellectual work done and no leadership. The betting was that the failure of the Labour Party in Scotland would hand a win to nationalism and to independence by default, so we don't need to solve any of the problems. And then we've got power, and it doesn't matter how calamitous the effect is on the people. So that's the nature of the Scottish independence movement. And you're seeing people who believe deeply in it are now starting to speak out.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, let's move on to something slightly different. But there's been an interesting story appearing in the press to do with the sinking of the Norwegian frigate. And what's emerged is that a US Navy officer was on board this ship. Now, in the first instance, this is not unusual because particularly younger officers are exchanged between navies. This has gone on for probably 100 years, maybe a little bit longer. So they spend some time on board the warship of a overseas nation to learn a bit about what it is, but also to help bonding and international relations. But it's emerged nevertheless that an officer was on board the ship, and it appears to be possible that he was actually on the bridge at the time of the collision, because it's now being reported that he may face questioning alongside the other officers, the other Norwegian officers on board the ship. Of course, this has itself raised some questions, because back in 2017, there were a spate of particularly unpleasant collisions between US warships and, in one case, a tanker, which resulted in the deaths of US sailors. So the Americans have got a very bad track record at the moment with safety, basic safety of their warships. And people are picking up on the fact that it is possible that there was an American officer on board the bridge of the ship. It's quite an interesting story. Mark, perhaps you might like to reply on this. Where this goes, I don't know, but this whole collision is extremely unusual. How did it happen? The speeds were very slow. How is it possible for a modern warship not to see what was a relatively big tanker?
Well, and the question is, how does a country with a budget the size that the United States have clearly have potentially a training issue here? Isn't that what's going on?
Well, that would appear to be what's going on, Mike. Yeah.
Any thoughts, Mark?
I don't have any deep insights into this, guys. It's obviously a consequence on one level of the U.S. patrolling the globe nonstop. The more things you have going on and the more money you spend and the more tools and toys you have, the more things that can go wrong. It's really just a consequence more than anything else of the global policing regime that the U.S. has been, especially since the end of the last World War. Maybe it's something along the lines of the F-35 debacle. Lots of new gizmos and toys that are not being fully tested. Lots of defense contracts, multi-billions of dollars flowing. It's more important to fulfill the contracts than to get really good equipment, and training is obviously lacking. So the U.S. is simply spread too thin across the globe. That's the easy answer, but it's the most applicable thing at this time based on what I know about it.
Yeah, and it will be very interesting if we are able to see details of the result of the Norwegian investigation as to what actually what took place on board, but something strange is going on. Well, we'll end on the subject of Theresa May. I couldn't resist this one because I was sent two particular communications today with Theresa May. But what a difference. Theresa May on the left as a Home Secretary, looking quite fresh-faced. And on the right, the Theresa May that's now in the bunker over Brexit. And to my mind, there's been a huge change in this lady. In fact, well, I better read it for our... listeners, but on the left is a young, fresh-faced Theresa May, and we've said that she is saying, "But I thought the Conservative Party was about such nice people, tea and biscuits, and helping the nation." And on the right is a particularly vile-looking Theresa May, telling her to shut up, you fool. We're about power, wars, and vast wealth. I am not you anymore. And I don't need you, Theresa. It is like there's been a major change in this woman since she's been elevated to power in the Conservative Party. And I don't think this is accidental. David, you might have some comment possibly on this.
Well, just a few words as we close up. I just want to thank Mark Anderson again. Every time he comes on, I learn things about what's happening in my own country. Just in the last 24 hours, we've had a major announcement of a thing called the Tay Cities deal, a lot of money going into a regional deal based on Dundee and Perth. So we don't have a big city there, but we're going to amalgamate two smaller ones into a single entity. So that's interesting. I like the fact that the G9 issues shows without any shadow of a doubt that Trump is not part of a deep state and they hate him, and that should endear him to us to at least some degree. And also, I love the point on Trump again that Bruno Studer couldn't use the term fake news, right? Because this is their term, and Trump has captured it, right? The way the Eighth Army captured Lily of Marlene, Trump has captured the phrase fake news and made it his own, so much so that the deep state doesn't want to play that game anymore and is looking for other types of language.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Well, gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. That's the end of UK Column News. Can I say thank you very much to people who've made donations over the last couple of weeks, and particularly the people who have taken out life memberships. So if that's something you've been thinking about, we would love you to join us with a life membership. We also do need your donations and subscriptions because we think it's vital that we carry on doing what we do, but also expand. Mm. And as somebody has said in our chat box today, I can see what is going on. And we hope that we've helped by our analysis to show people what is actually happening around them. And at the end of the day, you won't be viewing or listening to this sort of analysis on the BBC. That's it. We'll be back on Monday at 1 o'clock.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.